You are listening to CFRC Radio from Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca.
Hey, 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 this is Disco Rick. Got a brand new show, Dance Floor Dispatch. We're going to be playing all the best house, electronic, and obviously we're going to be playing some disco. It's every Saturday night at 10 p.m. Tune in at CFRC 101.9.
Hi, I'm James Abrams.
And I'm John Abrams.
And we're the Abrams Brothers. And you're listening to CFRC 101.9.
Please support community radio.
When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
Good evening. It is 5 p.m. and this is Today in YGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. Today in YGK is brought to you by your CFRC News Collective, Ara McCauley, Jesse Bell, and Jenny Hinch. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and for our podcasts, Smith Engineering at Queen's University. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Ara McCauley, and here are your local news headlines. On Friday, the City of Kingston sent out a press release sharing services available to the community as extreme heat continues. While the most recent orange heat warning has been lifted for the region, temperatures are still expected to hover between 25 and 28 degrees throughout the rest of this week, not taking the Humidex into consideration, which can often make it feel much hotter. The release, which acknowledges the increasing frequency of consistently high temperatures and extreme heat events, outlines the ways in which the city is working to ensure everyone, and particularly individuals who are unhoused, has access to spaces to stay cool, safe, and healthy during volatile weather. The City of Kingston Housing and Social Services 2026 Summer Response Plan includes information for community members on cooling centers, public washrooms, and street outreach services, as well as a water distribution program which involves partner agencies, volunteer groups, and street outreach picking up and distributing water as needed. In the release, Jane Hartley, Director of Housing and Social Services, stated that everyone is aware and very concerned for the welfare of individuals who are living outside in conditions that in some cases have been completely unpredictable, especially in recent days. We really want to keep people safe and let them know that there are services where they can come in from the extreme heat or stormy weather, whatever it might be. The current list of cooling center locations on the City of Kingston website includes the Invista Center and Cataraqui Center in the West End, Calvin Park Library Branch Midtown, the Central Library Branch Downtown, Kingston East Community Center and Pittsburgh Library Branches in the city's East End, Rideau Heights Library Branch in the North, and Housing and Social Services at 362 Montreal Street. Hours for each location vary, though most outside of public library branches, which are closed on Sundays, are open every day. Evening shelter, however, is a real challenge as the latest center closes at 9 p.m. and most emergency shelters operate at or very near full capacity. A Kingston community member's Reddit post following last week's tornado warning in Kingston highlighted the elevated risk to unhoused individuals of extreme weather events beyond just heat, with images of the Bell Park encampment showing several tents destroyed by high winds and falling branches. While no major injuries were reported, it was reported that one individual sustained a likely concussion after being struck by a branch while sheltering in place in their tent. According to Environment Canada, the safest thing you can do during a tornado is to get as close to the ground as possible and protect your head and watch out for flying debris. Most deaths and injuries occur when buildings collapse or when people are struck by flying debris, especially glass. If you are indoors, the safest place is the lowest and most central room, preferably a basement or cellar. They advise that you get under a sturdy piece of furniture and use your arms to protect your head and neck. Do not open windows and do not use elevators. If you find yourself outdoors, get inside right away if possible. And if you can't get inside, lie flat in a ditch or sunken ground and cover your head with your hands. Do not go under an overpass or bridge. For extreme heat events, Environment Canada advises those outdoors to slow down, drink water, and stay as cool as possible by wearing light, loose clothing and keeping in the shade. According to a 2025 article published by the Journal of Urban Health titled Heat-Related Health Risks for People Experiencing Homelessness, a Rapid Review, extreme heat poses a significant public health threat for people experiencing homelessness who faced heightened risks due to prolonged outdoor exposure and limited access to resources. It noted that in addition to physical health-related health risks, mental health and substance use disorders can also be exacerbated by heat exposure, all of which can lead to a significant increase in emergency department visits among unhoused individuals during heat events. The research argues that improving housing access and stability is essential as a long-term strategy to decrease homelessness and reduce heat stress in this vulnerable population, and underscores the need for inclusive interventions such as accessible cooling centers with targeted programming, regular access to water, and tailored healthcare services. The city notes that so far in 2026, approximately 10,600 bottles and 420 cases of water have been distributed, with 139 cases distributed in June alone. The 2026 Summer Response Plan, which can be found on the city's website under Homelessness Services, provides a list of day and emergency shelters and drop-in services such as meals and social services. For more on this topic, be sure to tune into Wednesday's Today in YGK, where we'll be speaking to a communications specialist from Southeast Public Health about what individuals can do to stay safe during extreme heat events, as well as warning signs to look out for. Also speak to representatives from the Kingston chapter of SCAN, Seniors for Climate Action Now, about their proposal before City Council to proclaim July 15, 2026 as Extreme Heat Awareness Day in the City of Kingston, stating that extreme heat is the most dangerous of all climate change events combined. Vulnerable citizens, including the very young, seniors, those with chronic diseases, outside workers, the unhoused, and those living in poverty are all at risk. Kingston citizens should be aware of the dangers of extreme heat and know how to protect themselves. Covering a story that may have been overshadowed by other discussions, coming as it did at the tail end of last council meeting, which ran for nearly 5 hours, council voted unanimously in favor of a motion put forward by Councillor Glenn to direct staff to advocate for the city at the federal level. The motion came in response to the federal LeBlanc-McKinnon discussion papers and called for formal partnerships with federal government.
Whereas Kingston is not asking for special treatment, but to be recognized for what it already is, a proven national asset, a functioning defense hub, a research and health sciences center, and community that has served Canada's national interest for generations.
We don't get noticed if we don't speak up, so it's important to do that.
On May 8th, the Government of Canada launched an engagement period to propose a simplified and accelerated process for federal regulatory reviews, citing current timelines that can see decisions on federal reviews exceed 12 months. The government claims the reforms will speed up building projects, increase efficiency, and allow for larger scale activities, while still being mindful of environmental concerns and the rights of Indigenous peoples. The high amount of early feedback from the new process has led the government to extend the initial engagement period to July 22nd, after many stakeholders asked for the opportunity to provide input on the reforms. The motion passed at council directs staff to submit formal written responses to the federal LeBlanc-McKinnon discussion papers, including a request for the federal government to establish a former partner community framework with the City of Kingston to coordinate national investments with municipal infrastructure capacity and planning. Councillor Glenn spoke to the motion, citing the impacts and opportunities these changes bring, and argued why advocacy beyond the Federal Canadian Municipalities, FCM, is required.
So the reason for this motion is that things are moving very quickly. And as a city, I think it's incredibly important that we make sure that we are advocating appropriately for Kingston. So although advocacy is happening through FCM, and yesterday I attended, well, co-chaired, the Defense Task Force second meeting, and I had CAO Hurdle attend with me. So we were able to speak with Chief of Staff General Kerrigan and also with Assistant Deputy Minister Pete Hammersmith and municipal councillors from across the country. The impact that this is going to have on our city is real, but the opportunity before us is also enormous. So the biggest thing that I think we need to do right now is to support all of the various agencies, bodies, and organizations in our community. And by advocating in this way, we can do that. We know that change is coming, and we know that there's going to be pressure put on infrastructure. We've already had a very long discussion this evening about infrastructure.
Glenn further spoke to the development of a defense community infrastructure fund.
So one of the things that FCM is advocating for is a defense community infrastructure fund. So we're asking that money that's already allocated be set aside to ensure that should any military building get done here, that they commit to investing in our community. So not just the pipes, but also into the soft infrastructure like childcare, doctors, also housing, so that not everything necessarily lands on the base. So this is a really important piece because what's coming is going to be huge. The estimate right now from the base commander is that in the next couple of years, we're going to see 1,000 new positions on the base. That's 1,000 new families. In addition to that, others coming from headquarters. So quite a number of people. And then there'll be all the supports that go along with it.
The motion points to the City of Kingston's position at the intersection of national economic and security architecture, citing Canadian Forces Base, CFB Kingston, the Royal Military College, RMC, Queen's University, Kingston Health Sciences Centre, a growing cybersecurity and AI sector, and Kingston's designation as the fifth busiest via rail station in Canada. The federal government has earmarked $81.8 billion in new defense spending through Budget 2025 and $6.6 billion in targeted industrial investment, including the Aalto High-Speed Rail Project through the Defense Industrial Strategy.
One of the positions that I think is important for us to take is to flag our interest in being a trade corridor. So the LeBlanc-McKinnon papers are very specific on this. I think it's important for us to put our names forward and say that we really want to do this. And last but certainly not least, we have talked ad nauseum about rail. Now is the time to also emphasize how critically important it is that we have appropriate rail service to Kingston. Our primary product from the defense side is going to be people. It's going to be individuals who are innovating, who are creating the next great thing, who are actually providing that innovation to the defense. We've got to be able to get those individuals in and out of here easily. So if we're going to expand the number of people on the base, if we're going to be able to bring experts in and out and allow them to collaborate together, they need to be able to get here quickly and easily.
The motion argues that ambition at the national level must translate into partnerships at the local level, stating the federal government cannot build 125,000 new defense jobs, modernize national supply chains, and construct a $60 to $90 billion high-speed rail network while leaving communities that host its military bases, train its officers, conduct its defense research, and carry its passengers to absorb the consequences on property tax revenues.
The turnaround time for these is quick. Everything is going to move at light speed. So the Kingston Economic Development Corporation has already had a meeting by the base with several military community members attending to speak to small and medium-sized businesses about how they can engage and how they can benefit from what's to come. So it's important for us, again, to provide that support by indicating our interest in being partners. So although this is happening again at the national level, it's important that we speak up as a community because we are one of the key hubs here. We could really bring some amazing things here to the city that would impact us economically in an incredibly positive way.
That wraps up your headlines for this evening. Next up is Jesse Bell with your CFRC Sports Desk.
This is Jesse Bell with your sports report brought to you by CFRC Power Plays, and today we are once again taking a look at the NBA offseason, including a massive trade involving the Toronto Raptors. The Charlotte Hornets continue to trade off some of their key young core, sending forward Miles Bridges along with a 2029 first and 2027 second round pick to the Phoenix Suns in exchange for Grayson Allen, Royce O'Neal, and a 2033 first round pick. For the Hornets, who also traded star point guard LaMelo Ball last week, this is a confirmation that they plan on building their team around their forward duo of Brandon Miller and Con Knupple. The Memphis Grizzlies and Portland Trail Blazers have agreed to terms on a trade centered around Memphis's star point guard Ja Morant. Morant, a former Rookie of the Year, has suffered a number of injuries and suspensions over the last three seasons, drastically decreasing his trade value. As such, The Memphis Hall is much smaller than what it would have been, say, 2 years ago. Memphis does get two solid forwards in Grant and Murray, but if things work out for the Trailblazers and Morant returns to his all-star form, they may have a perfect pairing alongside veteran point guard Damian Lillard. A blockbuster trade involving the Toronto Raptors was made, as the Raptors sent forward Brandon Ingram, guard Grady Dick, two first-round picks, two second-round picks, and a first-round pick swap to the Los Angeles Clippers in exchange for Kawhi Leonard. Leonard last played for the Raptors in 2019, leading the squad to, so far, their only NBA title in franchise history. Kawhi is coming off one of his better and healthier seasons in 2026, putting up 27 points a game while also providing elite defensive ability. This is a high-risk, high-reward deal for the Toronto Raptors. Let's look at some of the pros and potential cons at play here. One of the big pros for the Raptors is the obvious upgrade from Brandon Ingram to Kawhi Leonard. Ingram underperformed, especially in the 2026 playoffs, and the Raptors also give Grady Dick a fresh start. Dick looked promising in his rookie season, but hasn't lived up to that potential since. Now, when Kawhi Leonard is healthy, the Raptors will have a top 10, arguably top 5 player on their roster, but health has not been a strong point over the last couple seasons for Leonard. When he's in the lineup, he will form one of the most defensively versatile front courts in the NBA alongside Scottie Barnes and Colin Murray-Boyles. That's when he's healthy. It's also worth noting that Kawhi Leonard could be facing possible discipline from the NBA for his role in the aspiration tree planting scandal. To make a very long story short, Leonard was essentially given a no-show job with a charitable organization as a way to circumvent the NBA salary cap by the Clippers owner, Steve Ballmer. Now, it's more likely that the NBA will focus their discipline on the Clippers organization rather than Kawhi Leonard, but nothing is a guarantee. The last time Leonard played for the Raptors, he was integral in taking home the franchise's first, and so far only, NBA title. Can he rekindle that 2019 magic? Or will the Raptors find themselves in a Brooklyn Nets-type situation where they make a massive trade involving a number of future draft picks for a superstar, only for that superstar to barely play? And worth noting, he's only on a one-year deal. Leave the organization again. It's high risk, high reward. This trade will either make the Raptors or break the Raptors. That's a wrap for your sports report brought to you by CFRC Power Plays. Coming up next, your traffic and weather reports for the Kingston region. This is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. Bath Road from Sir John A. Macdonald Boulevard to Portsmouth Avenue. Expect delays for the installation of intersection pedestrian signals. The city is installing these signals at several locations to make it easier and safer for pedestrians to cross busy roads. They are being installed at the following intersections: Bath Road at Lafleur Park, Concession Street at Kings Court Avenue, and Stephen Street at Patrick Street. Wright Crescent at Palace Road to Palace Road is closed for a contractor to complete roadway repairs, pedestrian safety and access improvements, and traffic calming features on Wright Crescent. Norman Rogers Drive from Sir John A. Macdonald Boulevard to Van Order Drive. Starting June 15th, Norman Rogers Drive is closed to through traffic to facilitate roadway rehabilitation and configuration improvements. This work will improve road condition, accessibility, and safety for all road users, including students, families, and local residents. The City of Kingston and Utilities Kingston are in the midst of a reconstruction of Princess Street. This major infrastructure project includes upgrades to underground and above-ground utilities, as well as improvements to enhance safety and comfort for pedestrians and cyclists. The City of Kingston is undertaking asphalt resurfacing on Johnson Street from University Street to Sydenham Street and Berry Street from Brock Street to Clergy Street West. Work includes the installation of a new top lift of asphalt and new pavement markings. Motorists and residents should expect daily road closures from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. with limited access during paving operations. Residents are asked to follow all posted signage and traffic control. The project is expected to be complete by July 10th. Berry Street from Queen to Queen is closed for construction-related activity at 283 Queen Street, and Aberdeen Street from Johnson to William is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. We begin with Monday, July 6th. 27 is your high, feeling closer to 30, so still quite warm, but not quite at the level that we saw last week. UV index of 10, so if you are outside, make sure you put on your sunscreen. Tuesday, July 7th, similar conditions, 27, just a shade warmer, feeling closer to 31, and it's going to be a very humid day with a lot of sunshine, another UV index of 10. Wednesday, July 8th, 26 is your high, and because of the cloudy conditions, it's going to feel like 26, UV index only of 6, dropping down to 18 overnight. Thursday, July 9th, 27 is your high with a mix of sun and cloud in the morning, becoming more cloudy into the afternoon. There is a possibility of rain, but it's only hovering around 17%, so it looks like it'll be another dry day here in the city of Kingston. Friday, July 10th, 27 is your high, feeling like 28 with the clear conditions in the forecast. A very sunny day here in the city of Kingston. Perfect start to your weekend. Saturday, July 11th, 26 is your high, feeling closer to 29. A few clouds in the sky, but largely sunny conditions, dropping down to 18 overnight. Sunday, July 12th, a beautiful, crisp, bright sunny day here in the city of Kingston, feeling closer to 30, UV index of 9, dropping down to 18 overnight. And then starting off next week, Monday, July 13th, 25, cloudy with a 55% chance of precipitation. It will be quite humid, feeling closer to 29 degrees, factoring in the humidity.
Hello, Kingston, and welcome back to CFRC 101.9 FM. Broadcasting from Kingston, Ontario, I'm CFRC's Community News and Arts Coordinator, Jenny, and this is your weekly events and concerts calendar brought to you by Flying V Productions. Whether you're looking for live music, community events, workshops, markets, or family-friendly activities, there is plenty of happening in Kingston this week, so let's get into it. Starting off strong with Monday, the Tet Center opens Paper Pulse Regeneration, a new exhibition exploring sustainability through paper-based art. If you're looking to brush up on your French, Café Franglais takes place over lunch on Sydenham Street. In the evening, Craft and Create returns to the Central Branch Library, while live music includes Nolan Hubbard at the Cove Inn, the Mourning Doves at Musiki, and Jake Vondeland and the Sturgeon River Boys at Signal Brewery. Tuesday offers a few unique activities, including ASL Workshop on Sydenham Street and Teddy Bear Hospital at the Central Library, where kids can bring their favorite stuffed animals to learn about healthcare in a fun, hands-on way. Salsa in the Square also returns to Springer Market Square with music from Los Garcia, while the evening features Bill Kirchin performing at the Pros and Cons Benefit on Wolf Island. Wednesday features a creative mix of activities around the city, including the Solar Punk Writing Lab at Calvin Park Library and Games in the Square downtown. Music lovers can catch the Limestone Jazz Collective as part of the Swinging Summer Concert Series at City Hall, along with performances by Jay Harris at Spacer's Dockside and Arms Length, Mile End, and Meathead at the Broom Factory. Thursday marks the start of the Kingston Buskers Rendezvous, filling downtown streets with buskers and performers throughout the weekend. Families can also enjoy stories in the square, while the evening includes drag bingo at Daff Brewery and Buddhist meditation classes at the Sphere. Live music highlights include Mo Kenny at the Broom Factory, Matthew Holtby, Lane Rodsep, and Daniel Raymond at Musiki, and Queer Kong at Hotel Wolf Island. Friday brings plenty to explore with the Buskers Rendezvous continuing downtown and a quick and cute card making and scrapbooking workshop at the Tet Center. In the evening, Kicking It Country takes over the City Hall atmosphere, while music fans can catch In the Key of Blue at the Isabel Bader Center. Tim Baker at the Hayloft Dance Hall, The Oreos at the Waterfront, and Violet Archers with Hugh Christopher Brown on Wolf Island. Heading into Saturday, the Busker Rendezvous continues along the Saturday Session Concert Series in Confederation Park. Other highlights include the Mending Way Clinic at Cultivate Arts Common, the Napanee Country Jamboree, Tunes in the Tower featuring Kevin and the Kitchen Sink at Murney Tower, and another performance in the Key of Blue. Live music also includes Hoofs Here at Spicer's Dockside, Jason Kent at the Coven, and Ginny and Rearrangers with Squid Pistol at Overtime Sports Bar. Wrapping things up, Sunday, the Memorial Center Farmers Market returns from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m., while the final day of the Kingston Buskers Rendezvous continues downtown. Music includes the afternoon performance of In the Key of Blue, Head Over Heels at the Coven, Steve Gerberson Open Mic, and Live Band Karaoke with the Oreos at the Merchant Tap House. That's your weekly events and concert calendar for July 6th through the 12th. And for more information on any of these events, visit the CFRC website and keep it locked right here on CFRC 101.9 FM. This is your events calendar brought to you by Flying V Production, bringing live theater, comedy, and unforgettable entertainment to audiences across Kingston. Be sure to check out their up-and-coming shows and events through the season. I'm Jenny. Thanks for listening, and have a great week, Kingston.
Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and listen on the go, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and for our podcast, Smith Engineering at Queen's University. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
Are you listening from inside a local prison, or do you have a friend or loved one in a local prison or youth detention center? Calls from Home is a monthly radio program for you. On Calls from Home, we share voicemails, messages, song requests, and dedications. Anyone can contact us with a message or song request for a friend or loved one on the inside. To get in touch, call or text 613-917-1390. Email cfrcprisonradio@riseup.net or send us a message on Instagram at cfrcprisonradio. The CFRC radio signal reaches the following local and regional prisons: Millhaven, Bath, Collins Bay and Frontenac, Joyceville and Pittsburgh, the Sundance Youth Detention Center here in Kingston, Quinte in Napanee, and the Cape Vincent Correctional Facility in upstate New York. Messages and song requests will be broadcast once per month on Wednesday between 7 and 8 p.m. here on CFRC 101.9 FM or on the web at cfrc.ca. For 2025, Calls from Home will air on the following dates: April 16th, May 14th, June 11th, July 9th, August 6th, September 3rd, October 1st, October 29th, November 26th, and December 24th. Please send in your message at least one day before the broadcast date. These upcoming show dates, contact info, and additional information is available online at cfrc.ca or on Instagram at CFRC Prison Radio. We look forward to receiving your messages and sharing them over the airwaves.
On CFRC 101.9 FM every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 p.m., you'll hear Finding a Voice. My name is Bruce, host of that poetry-focused spoken word program. On it, you'll hear local readings and events, occasionally telephoned interviews across Canada, and always a touch of music. Again, Finding a Voice, here every Friday from 4 to 6 p.m. Check it out. Hope to catch you there.
Good day. You're listening to Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph. Thanks for tuning in. This is edition 324. The program this week is the final in a series of three special episodes looking at the Civil Society Summit on the AI industry. This was a critical gathering looking at the voices of labor activists, environmental justice activists, Indigenous voices, artists, and many others to look at the impacts of AI on our communities, on the land, on the water, and basically to present a critical view at this time where we see a liberal federal government in Canada openly embracing AI data centers. This gathering was co-hosted by the Council of Canadians. And on the broadcast this week, I am going to be sharing some perspectives on an important panel that took place as part of this summit, this gathering. It is on AI systems' impact on migrants and the immigration process. We will hear from three different voices. Abdullah Daoud, who is the founder of the Refugee Center, a Montreal-based nonprofit who supports refugees and newcomers, supporting them through things like legal, employment, housing, and integration services. And so Abdullah, I think, offers some really important insights as to how AI systems impact migrants here in Canada. Also, we hear from Mustafa Hanawi, who is an author and community organizer with the Immigrant Workers Center. He is the author of Essential Work, Disposable Workers, Migration, Capitalism, and Class. And Gabriel Bergevin Estable, a research fellow in geography of migration, connected to the Canada Research Chair in Global Migration Dynamics. These are the voices that we'll hear in this section. So now we'll hear those perspectives.
So yes, I think in my area of work, which primarily deals with policy and also with refugee claimants, asylum seekers in Canada, the Centre Refugee is probably sees around 12 to 13,000 claimants a year, all of which need legal help. That is the number one ask about their claims. So we started a clinic back in 2017 with the primary focus of let's try to help as many people as possible at this stage of their claim or their migration process or the refugee claim in Canada, because if you're not capturing them at this stage, it becomes significantly harder for them afterwards, right? Mustafa can probably speak to that much better than I can. So now, I think to relate it to this topic, I can speak about so many problems, but to relate it particularly to this topic, we are seeing a government and the Carney government that is operating on this idea of deterrence. They're trying to install in people's heads that, hey, people shouldn't come here to seek safety, right? So if you apply for a visa application and you know you're a little bit dishonest just to get here to claim safety, then you shouldn't be here, right? We should try to focus on reducing asylum claim numbers, right? I mean, on a moral and ethical level, that's something else, but that's not a legitimate reason, right? That's not a reason to say, hey, we should try to just stop these people from coming. Over 80% of refugee claims that go to the Immigration Refugee Board of Canada are accepted. So 8 out of 10 people come here on legitimate needs so far that we know of to seek safety. And the other two could be for other reasons, that they might not have had good access to legal representation. They might not have had good documentation. They might have been not understanding the process. On appeals, we even have an extremely high acceptance rate, right? So this premise of we should have a stronger border act, right? So I don't know if anyone here heard of Bill C-12 that recently passed. It also goes on this idea of deterrence. It's this idea of let's limit the structures and the policies and the laws in any way possible, even if we're going to go against our own charter, which they have, right? Even there's under testimony or under statement, the previous Minister of Immigration, who was probably the mastermind behind C-12, has said that it'll probably go against certain constitutional rights. We need to set this precedent to stop people from coming. And baked into the idea is how our AI systems are now going to be used in the IRCC and the IRB, right? In reality, the bias is baked in, right? So when we see IRCC officers or CBSA officers and we say, okay, this particular case was done for profiling, and you know they'll chalk it off and be like, this is just one officer, you know? This is the data that these AI systems are feeding from to build and to triage what gets seen by the IRCC and the IRB and the CBSA and what doesn't, right? What's illegible and whatever is ineligible has to be reviewed, right? So now we're creating systems where we're trying to bake in the profiling. Now we're actually making it very clearly and evidently systemic. That's the premise in which I approach this. And also from a funding perspective, the ideas and the proposals that come to me now that try to use AI in ways that I think could be good, but also could be dramatically bad. And we'll get into that as well.
So in terms of the two issues, I mean, both I'll speak on the labor thing, but also in terms of immigration and the question of deterrence, I think, is not just keeping people out or the ability to come and seek safety, but increase the numbers of people you can actually squeeze out of the country, right? And, I mean, I think our immigration policy is never about how many people actually come to the country, but how they can be controlled, right? I mean, that's fundamentally the major aim of Canada's immigration regime, right? The numbers game is a bit of a theater, right? We see this in Quebec. We see this, you know, all this, there's too many immigrants, and then Quebec turns around and says, well, actually, we need more temporary foreign workers, right? So it's always a question of how you can actually control migration, right? And so one of the ways that we see this question of deterrence, and I think one of the things that really relates to AI is sort of this idea that artificial intelligence will make things efficient, right? But we've actually seen a gross amount of inefficiency, right? Like the wait times for many people who are here is turning Canada fundamentally into a prison on purpose, right? So one of your last options as a failed asylum seeker is what's called the humanitarian and compassionate application. The wait times in Canada can now range between 10 and 50 years to have your application accepted. So the idea is to squeeze people to that. They're separated so much from their families for such a long time that essentially they'll just turn around and go home themselves. That this is fundamentally the aim, right? In practice and on the ground. And again, in synthesizing, right? Because the idea of our refugee system is on the individual basis of the claim, right? But you see internal notes, internal memos, sort of grouping stories, using that data, where people are coming from, are these legitimate or illegitimate asylum claims, you know, for the 2 out of the 10 that aren't accepted, right? So particularly people coming from Francophone Africa have been lumped in with internal memos being like, these are illegitimate claims. So what is the basis that they're actually, you know, using AI to actually triage these claims and triage applications in general, right? And I think it's really to take away the very structure of our immigration system, which is the basis that every individual claim will be treated individually, right? As soon as you start using metadata or analytics or algorithms, then you strip away the very basis of our immigration system. Right. And I think that is a fundamental issue, and not baked in is not only bias, but also, racism, xenophobia, and to be able to bring in the ideal immigrant while trying to keep away the non-ideal migrant. Right. And on the issue of work, and I think this is something that is really important for a lot of immigrants and migrants, Amazon's closed, but, you know, a big issue for me personally and within the IWC is the way that AI is being used in the workplace as a supervisor. And one of the things that, you know, and writer Alessandro Del Fante actually, you know, talks about this is that, you know, humans are still cheaper than robots, right? And particularly migrant workers are still cheaper than robots. And so a company like Amazon, which never left Quebec, right? It's everyone's still receiving their packages, right? So even though it's physically gone, the AI, the algorithms, all of that remain in place, and the jobs have become worse, have become more precarious, and a lot of that is a result of artificial intelligence, the deployment of AI. And so Amazon is the second largest private employer on earth, only behind Walmart. So 1.5 million people who work in their warehouses, who are delivering packages, and these aren't the subcontractors as well, are managed by algorithms and by artificial intelligence, right? So the world screams about Big Brother and surveillance and AI in China. But yet, 10 hours a day, over a million people are managed by AI. And one of the things this creates and does, it totally evades the law. So the kind of surveillance that you see. So a few quick anecdotes. So inside Amazon, all the cameras are controlled by AI, right? They give reports to the supervisors every 6 minutes, and then are amalgamated at the end of the day and have the right to punish, discipline workers, right? So you can be suspended. A lot of the stories that you hear about Amazon, workers hiding in the bathroom, et cetera, the reason why workers do that, it's the only place that they can't put an AI camera is in the toilet. So when people who are overworked, underpaid, are trying to find a break, the only place you can hide is in the bathroom. But yet there's no regulation around AI. Workers are fired automatically through AI programs. Workers are given their tasks through these AI programs. So no one knows a worker is 60 with a bad back. But the AI program will say, do you know what? It's your turn to pick up the 30-kilo package, and you've only got 10 seconds to move that package from the conveyor belt into the right tote bag, right? The AI program doesn't know that. So it's taken away any responsibility from the supervisors and has caused a lot of damage upon workers, has disciplined workers, and has evaded the law. A lot of workers have, you know, that we work with lost their claims or have had to have their claims, you know, sort of challenged in the labor courts on the basis that AI is actually the supervisor. The supervisors aren't the supervisors, but it's actually the algorithm that's the supervisor, right? But the algorithm can't be seen as breaking the law, right? Or our labor laws. So I think to me, in the way, and it's not just Amazon, right? Because Amazon's sort of the, you know, every employer looks to be the next Amazon. While employers might not have the amount of money to invest in those AI programs or algorithms, eventually it'll become cheap enough for them to be able to do so. So you're going to start seeing what Amazon has deployed across workplaces, right? And we're beginning to see that more and more and more. And yet there's no stop and ask that this is forms of harassment. This is breaking our health and safety laws. This is undermining our basic, you know, basic labor standards, right? But there isn't that discussion on that scale. And unfortunately, even with the closures of Amazon, we didn't have that discussion here in Quebec. So to me, I think the way that it's being used in workplaces, especially in low-wage workplaces, is fundamental. And I don't think it's about replacing labor, but it's about making it more controlled and exploited, right?
I think one of the key takeaways I want to bring is that there's a severe deficit in transparency at how the government is using AI. And one of the ways that this plays out right now is that we are always a step behind right now. Like the process that we carried out to get access to information documents, it certainly gave us a lot of information, but it came in 2 years late or 3 years late. They were already moving on ahead to the next steps of their implementation by the time we got the data, and then by the time we analyze it and then spread the results. Not only has IRCC moved on to more and more robust AI solutions, and they're more entrenched in that pathway, it's going to be harder to get them to reverse the steam, but they're being emulated by other institutions now. So, and I think we need to increase a lot of our awareness and be very intentional about how we think about AI and migrant rights in particular. You know, the Refugee Center and the Immigration Worker Centers do super important on the ground frontline work with migrants, and I've seen it a lot over the years. But I want to think about, like, more broadly, and not just the people here in this room, but more broadly in the Canadian society, most Canadians have not gone through a migration process. They're not intimately aware of how it works, the same way that they are aware of how it works to interact with the state when they file their taxes or renew their driver's permit. When you look at internal reports at IRCC of error rates in the work permit renewal program in 2019, 2020, those error rates were around 25% of refusals were refused by error. So people went out of status, no longer allowed to work, and one in four of them had been refused by error based on their own internal audits. I don't think we can imagine any other public sector service that's provided direct to the population where a 25% error rate would not be front page news and political priority of the moment, something to be fixed right away. But because it happens to migrants, because there's no transparency about these kinds of mistakes that are being integrated into the workflow more and more with AI and automation technology, There's no conversation. There's no broader conversation happening about them. So we need to be very intentional about understanding, especially for settlers, colonizers, people who were born with citizenship, who didn't have to go through the immigration process to understand what it can represent in people's lives, and also ask for our elected officials to be more accountable. Almost all MPs devote at least one staff member full-time to immigration casework. So it's actually super easy for a federal MP to get briefed on what works and what doesn't. It's just that maybe they don't get asked that much to be knowledgeable on these issues. We even see MPs sometimes on the immigration committee at Parliament who don't properly understand the immigration programs. So we need to ask more, I think, of our elected officials. We need to ask more of ourselves and our fellow members of our society in terms of understanding how the immigration system works, and ask for more transparency about how AI is used. I just want to, maybe just one last thing, is Canada's destination state for migration. Like, even if there's been a reduction with the new administration in terms of the deterrence, as you named it, overall, it's still one of the countries. It used to be in the top 10, maybe it's still in the top 15. I haven't looked at last year's global rankings, but it's still very high in terms of a destination. We're not in the top 10 or top 15 in terms of population, but we are in terms of a destination for immigration. And Canada's economy, right as it's structured, really depends on like having migrant workers' bodies here on the ground doing lots of hard work with bad conditions. The immigration system is designed to bring those people in, but also trying to find ways to prevent those people from accessing a full regime of rights that other people in Canada benefit from. There's lots of ways to do it, but there used to be a lot of tension between those two aspects, and a lot of these things are resolved in the courts. But more and more, they are using strategies of risk profile prediction to identify potentially problematic migrants in the application process, and then find ways to exclude them from getting an application approved, or delay them from having the application even processed, so that if they can't find a legal way to refuse them, they can just stall them out of the country by having extremely long processing times. When we think of Canada's history about, for example, ships of asylum seekers that were turned back, which are very sorry episodes of Canada's country, our AI systems that are looking through visa applications and triaging them are looking, amongst other things, for people who are at risk of applying for asylum. And they're pinpointing individuals who have different travel plans from different countries and finding ways to flag them for officers to potentially refuse the applications. They're not turning back one ship of people, so it's not a spectacle that will be on front page news, but every day they're refusing people for these kinds of reasons in much larger numbers than have ever come to Canada on any single ship. So we need to think more, be more aware of how these AI systems are reproducing the exact kind of dynamics that we don't want to see, but in more hidden ways. And then we need to request a lot more transparency from our government to be able to do that.
All right, thank you for this first round. So, Gabrielle, you already started talking about methods. So I'd like to dig into methods. And methods are important for researchers, for activists, for workers, for everyone who is engaged in resisting AI. And so I'd like to ask you all, how do you examine, study, organized around the impact of AI on migrants and immigration issues? So how do you do it?
In terms of research methods, there's actually a lot. I'll speak for our team. We've been, first we requested a lot of ATIP documents. Access to information and privacy. So it's a freedom of information in the U.S. has other names in other countries. You write to the government and you tell them, I hear that you have a document on this topic. I would like to have a copy of it, please. And then they'll censor out the things that they can't release for security reasons or whatnot. And then they'll provide you whatever's left of the document. Obviously, some of the documents that we have the table of contents and then everything else is empty. But a lot of the documents are actually very interesting, full of details. You can get emails also. You can ATIP email between different public servants, so you can look what they're emailing about, the meetings they're scheduling, what's the on the agenda for the meeting, things like that. So it's very boring stuff. It's fascinating when you find exactly what you're looking for. We're also doing, we did a round of interviews with people working in community groups, lawyers, immigration consultants, and staffers in MP offices about how, in the way that they help migrants interact with the administrative state, how they've seen changes with the introduction of AI and automation. For us, the next round is going to be interviews with public servants, seeing how their work has changed with the introduction of AI in their workplace.
For me, methods are split to when it comes to, like, I guess the more activist work, it really depends on what we see happening on the ground, right? I'll give an example, a more recent example. With the passing of Bill C-12, the Centre Refugee, we saw, I mean, they announced it also publicly, but 30,000 letters went out, about 33,000 letters went out to all asylum seekers that now they're no longer eligible, right? Because of this new policy. And one of these new policies that they introduced was, you know, if you've been in the country for more than a year from your first point of entry, so you could have came as a kid, left, came back later, claimed asylum, because it's been more than a year, you're ineligible, right? I'm sure everyone can think of 1,000 reasons of why that's grossly unethical. But, you know, when we quizzed officials as to why, how come, like, did a lot of these letters came out of nowhere, a lot of these letters didn't actually apply, a lot of letters went to people who are exempt from this, right? It was automated. It was like, okay, there was an algorithm that went in, saw dates of entry, saw this, made an automated decision, 33,000 letters went out, right? With zero repercussion as to the actual cases involved, right? Which then goes back to my previous point. This is the intention, you know, the veiled intention. I'm not so veiled anymore. Of the current government and its practice and what it needs to do. The the method of how to, and this is the unfortunate reality, is that it's tough. Policy always catches up to these realities, right? Whenever a new disruptive technology comes in, right? And disruptive is just like a sexy word for like extremely illegitimate and probably like human rights breaking and labor breaking type of technological interventions, right? The policy is reactive. The only time we see proactive policy is when the actual government officials themselves have their own intention to bring something on, and then they create the policy to create the to create the pathway for these things to happen, right? But from I guess from a community perspective and from an activist perspective, it's tough to be proactive in these things. But one very good tool of proactive policymaking is looking, and this is the good thing that's happening today in the world, is how interconnected we are, is looking where similar countries have tried this and failed, and why. There's been the use of AI. So when we look at AI, it's a broad term, right? There's a lot of things that aren't AI that they say are AI. There's a lot of things that are AI they don't say is AI. But in this particular case, when we talk about decision-making or generative AI that makes its own reasoning to conclude something, right? Usually using machine learning or huge data sets. We look at a country, for example, like the Netherlands. So the Netherlands introduced this system. Basically what it did, it was, hey, we want to root out welfare fraud and residency fraud in the country. And we're going to do this based on previous data sets of our immigration officers making these decisions, right? Almost immediately, it targeted the most low-income, vulnerable populations in the region. And it had such a horrendous outcome rate in terms of the amount of people accused of these things to the amount of the people who are actually guilty of those things. It went all the way to their high court. They got overturned and it got banned almost like within a year of its use. So these algorithmic tools, and again, like I said, that bake in this profiling, bake in these biases, this racism, this discrimination.
This has been another edition of Free City Radio. And we've heard voices from the Civil Society Summit on the AI industry. That was a gathering of activists, climate justice organizers, indigenous voices, and artists to look critically at the impacts of AI on labor, the environment, water, and our society at large. It was co-convened by the Council of Canadians, and I was happy to be there to document and record the event. You can visit aicivilsociety.ca for more information. This has been another edition of Free City Radio. We air weekly on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on Wednesdays at 11 a.m., on CGLO 1690 a.m. also in Montreal on Thursdays at 8 a.m., on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Tuesdays at 8 a.m. and Fridays at 1:30 p.m., on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston on Wednesdays at 11:30 a.m., on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria on Saturdays at 7 a.m., on Met Radio 1280 a.m. in Toronto on Fridays at 5:30 a.m., on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m., on CJSF 90.1 FM in Vancouver on Tuesdays at 4 p.m., and on CHMA 106.9 FM in Sackville, New Brunswick on Tuesdays at 10 a.m. You can find our archives at soundcloud.com/Free City Radio. We're also a podcast. Look us up. Just search Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph. Thanks so much for tuning in to this week's edition.
No static. No static. No static. No static. Mondays. 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 6 to 8. 6 to 8. 6 to 8. 6 to 8 p.m. 6 to 8 p.m. Mondays. 6 to 8 p.m. CFRC 101.9. CFRC.ca. No static. Mondays. 6 to 8 p.m.